You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the fourth season of the Dramatists Guild Presents Talkback. I'm your host, Christine Toy Johnson. We've shifted our focus this year to talk about craft and inspiration. Our guests this season are my colleagues and friends from the Council of the Dramatists Guild of America. Over the next six episodes, our guests will give us a unique look into how they write, what makes a good story, and what drives them to keep working on the DG Council. Stay with us.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
Welcome back to Talkback. In our first episode, I sit down with the Vice President of the Dramatists Guild, Brandon Jacobs Jenkins, while he's on set for his upcoming FX television show, Kindred, an adaptation of the Octavia Butler novel of the same name. Brandon has made his career in community with other writers. We'll talk about his passion for fair and equitable treatment of writers and his passion for R.L. Stine. I'm so excited to welcome the Vice President of the Dramatists Guild Council, Mr. Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. Can you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, my name is Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. I'm a playwright, an educator, and sometimes television writer, sometimes other kinds of writers. And I'm calling, or I'm speaking to you now from the middle of a trailer in the hills of Atlanta, where it is boiling hot. And that's the story of my life today.
Okay, thank you. This season is all about inspiration and craft. And I know that means many different things to many different people. And I wanted to start with asking you, you're such a prolific writer. How did it all begin for you? What inspired you to start writing?
It's so flattering and fraudulent for you to call me prolific, but I'm going to receive that and say thank you. You know, it's like impossible to feel productive these days. But I guess it started for me, honestly, with reading. I feel like I was just a gigantic reader starting from an early age. And I was very much into Goosebump books. And I remember it's the R.L. Stine kind of series that was had its heyday in the 90s. And I would go to the B. Dalton bookstore, which was the name of the bookstore. That I would think every month they released the new one, and I'd be there like using my allowance to buy it. And I think I read every single book. And after a few, maybe a couple years of reading the books, I had this experience where I read one, and I didn't like the ending. And so I decided I would rewrite the ending myself. And that's my first memory of basically being like, oh, I could tell a story, or I could tell, I want to see the story that I want to see, write the story that I want to see.
How old were you then?
And, God, I guess I want to say I was in second or third, maybe third or fourth grade.
Wow.
Because what happened soon after that is my mom was a working parent, and sometimes I would have to stay with her. She's a single mother as well. So sometimes I'd have to hang out at her office on days when I didn't have childcare. And I would just be stuck in her office with a computer, and I just one day opened up like a very crude kind of word processing platform and just started writing a story out of boredom while she was in a meeting. And then I remember being very fascinated because I like printed it out. And somehow she told my teacher about it, a guy named Mr. Toe, who's now no longer with us. And I think one day he just ran out of things to teach. And so he told me to come up in front of the class and read my story out loud. And that was like my first taste of performance.
Wow. How was that for you?
And I remember being super humiliated. It's about like detectives who happen to also be like martial arts experts. I mean, it's really bad stuff, but I think it was the first time I was ever singled out, or I felt the act of writing singling me out in a way that was like, oh, this isn't me and this is what I do and no one else seems to do it in this room. And I think that was quite formative for me. And then when I actually began writing plays is a little hazier, but the first like official play I wrote, we had this like end of year recital to a very small elementary school called Roots Activity Learning Center in Washington, D.C. And every year at the end of the year, we had the school-wide recital and every class kind of put on a performance. And somehow I convinced my best friend at the time was a guy named Chris Mickle. And I knew he wanted to be an actor. And it's like, well, I'll write you a play. And I wrote this really bad, very long play about a detective named Johnny Sanchez. And that was performed at our like sixth or seventh grade recital. And I didn't think of it as writing a play or even playwriting, but I was like, this is something to do. That's my earliest origins. I don't think I've ever told those stories.
That is so great.
For the beginnings of me writing things, writing stories.
I actually also wrote a play, my first play in sixth grade, and got my school to do it. It was called Wishes Do Come True, in which an actress who looked a lot like me auditioned for a Broadway show and got the show and then got a Tony Award and had a whole speech and everything. So that was,
you know, where you were obviously the star, as a star.
Yes,
vehicle.
Of I'm course. Obsessed. So we share that. As well as.
Yes. I think there must be something about that age. Yeah. There's something about the sixth grade year that is, that somehow you understand the lure of the stage somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. That's amazing.
That's funny.
I want to talk about a lot of things because you're working on several things right now, I know. Mm-hmm. You've been working on a new television series that you also created. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's technically an adaptation of a very famous book called Kindred by the late Octavia Butler. But yeah, I've been developing it for about 6-7 years, which I can't believe that. But and we're literally going to wrap shooting next week. So it's been enormous journey.
And is this your first stint with writing a television show?
No, I've actually done some quiet, secret television work over the last 8 or so years in a way that honestly a lot of playwrights I know. That's how we survived. My cohort, at least, since we weren't all going to Broadway. And I worked in the room for HBO's Watchmen, which I think most people kind of knew me for. I helped a friend of mine out with his show Out of Range, most recently for Amazon. So I've kind of dabbled. I've developed things that never went anywhere, but mostly just quiet struggles in the dark. I have to say, there was a period where I felt a little ashamed to talk about it because all I want is to be a playwright, but Broadway was not quite making ends meet in the way that I needed it to. Yeah.
So,
and also the health insurance. That's what everyone does.
Of course, yes.
You know. Yeah.
So are you the showrunner on your show here?
Yes, I'm the showrunner, executive producer, combo/writer, big kahuna.
So that's a lot.
Which is a totally new. Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. It's like being somehow both the playwright and the artistic director of the theater.
Wow.
And it's a huge mental shift, I would say, from what I'm used to, which is, you know, through the amazing gift of the Guild, owning my IP and having a lot of control over it, right, but still in some ways being an independent contractor versus in this role, part of my creative responsibilities is ultimately hiring and managing this kind of amazing village of human beings who show up to put this behemoth of a show together. So it was a real level jump in terms of how I thought about what creative work would look like. And it's just been such an amazing learning experience, honestly. And it's actually made me really appreciate and value the theater more than I ever have, because you don't know what you got till it's gone, ultimately. There's so much to celebrate about what we do. And it really is just like the best.
Yeah.
Like good theater is just the best. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that you bring up the whole idea of owning your intellectual property, because I think that is one of the biggest differences besides the money, writing a play on your own and being able to make all the decisions and nobody being able to change your words. And even though you're in charge, you're still answering to a lot of people, right?
Yeah, I definitely work for Walt Disney. I know the buck does not stop with me. And in some ways, I think writing for television is like a very interesting art of compromise, because you do have a vision for something that you want to try to maintain and get across, but in some ways you're constantly like having to give a little to get a little in every way. And it just makes you think differently about the work you're doing. I keep saying to people, like, I've never wanted more than now to be making a play, because there is something about that just like almost radical freedom that you get to feel in the theater that just, I don't think the television will ever honestly approach, because it's too big of a commercial venture, I think.
Yeah. I want to get to your plays a little bit later, but I have a follow-up question. You're working on a TV show that is an adaptation. How have you gone about coming up with new ideas that are in line or in alignment with the source material? And what keeps you inspired to keep finding new things to say?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think that adaptation is something that I think I'm regarded for in the theater. It's like it's been a part of my practice for a very long time, and I've given a lot of thought about it. I've taught classes on it. I've always felt that the theater at its heart, even historically, is an adaptive or an adaptational form. If you think about Shakespeare, he was synthesizing these source materials from like Italian folktales and English histories or whatever, and kind of making his worlds out of that kind of raw material. So for whatever reason, theater has always felt to me like a thing that is always adapting something. And the kind of magic of what we do is in asking ourselves what adaptation is. And I would say that the approach I always have to adapting is to honor the working in the grain of the original, meaning like, you know, I can literally teach a whole class on this.
You should, first, yeah, if you haven't.
The first thing I would say too is I always approach things as a fan. There's no point in adapting something that I don't want to see or spend time with. And that's really what keeps me going is, oh, I just love this thing so much. It's like, I want to just unpack my love for it. I want to love it more. I want to understand it. In some ways, maybe that's what love is ultimately. But that's what really keeps me going, is like an obsession almost with the thing. I can't adapt just anything. I have to weirdly be like intrigued or challenged by it. And I would say too, that I think a mistake a lot of adaptations make is the writer presupposes a kind of superiority to the original maker or the text. And I think like part of the fun of adapting is to try to really think of this dead person usually as an equal or a colleague, and understanding why they made the choices they made in the context of that they made them, what they might have been trying to do that they could or couldn't do based on the social world that was there to greet them. And so for me, I feel like when I am trying to adapt something that, especially when it's kind of beloved, I think to myself, like, what do I think? Like, Octavia Butler wrote this book in like the 70s, at a very different time, very different level of conversation and vocabulary around like a lot of the themes she's unpacking, which have to do with literally like family, race, identity, you know, all the stuff that now everyone writes about. And I had to ask myself, how can I find an echo or another iteration of those things in the present? That kind of is what ultimately guides some of my choices in adaptation. And then in terms of finding something new to say, I've been teaching now for a while, and I feel like I constantly, not constantly, not so much anymore, but I would have these students who would just feel like they had nothing to write about, or that everything had been written about under the sun. And I have to remind them that every day is a new day. No one's written about today. So you should write about today. It's where you are today and now. And it's always by definition going to be new, because no one's seen this day. And I feel like that's kind of what I try to cultivate in myself, is a sense of always just asking questions of the present and just noticing and thinking about how we got to where we got to now. That sort of winds up being the well I draw on again and again when I get stuck.
That is such great advice. What's interesting is that it seems like we started this conversation talking about Goosebumps, which you were already adapting when you were in grade school. So you were preparing for this moment.
That's true.
Back then.
Yeah, that's hilarious. What's funny is I found out that R.L. Stein is a subscriber at the Signature Theater, and that he has definitely seen my plays. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Someone confirmed that for me. Yeah, they were like, R.L. Stein saw this play this year. And I was like...
But you haven't met him yet. You haven't met him yet in person.
Ironically, this is another dumb story, but when I was 13 years old, my mother gave me this surprise where Arlstein was like speaking at some event space in Washington, D.C. And she got me tickets to it. And I was blown away that I was meeting a real life author who I admired. And as I was going into the auditorium to take my seat, this guy cuts in line in front of me just to go in. It's Arlstein.
Oh.
I think he either stepped on my shoe or I stepped on his shoe. And I was just like, it was definitely like touching the hem of a saint or something for a 13-year-old who was into like weird genre fiction. Anyway,
great.
Yes, that's the only time I ever met the man.
That's so great.
You know, ships in the night.
Speaking of the signature, you're going to have to fact check me on this, that you have a premiere of a new play that you're also directing coming up there.
Yes, that is the intention. Yes, there's a play called Grass that I'm in the process of finishing, which was actually slated for the COVID season that was canceled. So I'm one of the many strange casualties of that. And yeah, it's my final play in Residency 5 playwright there. And the late, amazing Jim Houghton, who invited me into the program, I would say 2014, I want to say. It was kind of almost 10 years ago. And the game was you get 3 premieres over 5 years or however long it takes. And there's like a carte blanche element to it. It was an invitation to dream as big as possible as a writer. And I remember even then I said, I want to direct my 3rd play. And that was just always the plan. So that's what we're hoping to finally make good on this spring.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, I'm nervous, but yeah, I feel like I've been in enough writer's rooms now. I know, honestly, like also the showrunner thing has made me very fearless.
Right, I'm sure.
And always, because there's just so many ways to be a director, to be a writer, to be anything. You just kind of have to figure out your lane.
Have you directed your own work before, other than the TV stuff?
Not officially, no. I did a sort of, I co-directed a college production of my play Everybody with someone many years ago. I mean, a lot of directors I work with have accused me of being a closeted director. I'm very invested in things like design of my work, and I have very specific ideas of performance. And I just feel like I came up doing community theater where, sure, there was like a named director, but everyone was doing everything. Everyone was building the sets. There's a dance captain, but also a choreographer. So I feel like my training has always been a little bit like, we're just all here to make a really good thing. You just kind of get in where you fit. And sometimes that means doing things that some directors might conservatively think of as only for them to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, I'm also just curious about taking that responsibility on myself and just trying to empathize in some ways with some of these amazing collaborators I've had over the years.
Yeah. I think that's so great and interesting to be able to get that perspective. And
I feel bad. Am I supposed to ask you questions?
No,
Christy?
No, this is, no. I'm interviewing you.
Oh, because I was going to ask you if you've ever been interested in directing.
I have actually, and I've directed several of my own pieces, and I quite enjoy it. I think because I like the opportunity to be really clear about what I have envisioned.
Exactly.
To communicate that with the actors. I'm not as well versed in imagining the visual elements, the scenic things, although I do tend to write a lot of magical realism, so I envision visual things that have to do with different worlds, but I'm not as good about being able to talk to a designer about what I would like to see that in that regard. But I really do enjoy it. I really do enjoy it.
I always am very fascinated by actor turned playwrights, which I'm not one of them. Because I always feel like you guys have a very intuitive sense of what makes something pleasurable for an actor to do. And I think that's so much the key that a lot of writers take forever to understand, that ultimately a show is made or broken on the actor. And if they've not been given like a vehicle in which to feel good, you may not get that kind of magic you crave. Like, I was thinking about Stephen Adley Gergis's work. Like, I'm obsessed. He's an amazing writer. And I always feel like he can build these kind of crazy ensemble shows. Is he just knows what an actor likes to do. And when his plays work, they feel like infectious.
Yeah.
They feel like this, like, group dance. It's Wow.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I honestly always approach building characters in the same approach. So I have had moments where I act everything out, of course, in my after I've written things. And I think, oh, I would be so mad at the playwright if I had to say this very long, convoluted sentence. Make it work.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. You did mention that you are still working on Grass. Where are you in the process of writing that play?
Oh, God. I'd be honest, I'm very superstitious, so I don't talk too much about it. I would say that I'm still finishing it.
Okay.
But it's been something that's been percolating for a very long time. I suspect it all. And I also, honestly, as a writer, I also rewrite a ton in rehearsal, which can often drive a certain kind of actor crazy.
Right.
So for me, things aren't really finished until I see the play that I'm thinking I'm writing.
Yes, you know? Yes.
Like every production I've ever walked into, the script has been in my spirit, like a kind of draft of the event we're building and discovering in the process.
But that's exciting because you're collaborating with everyone in the room at the same time then, and
yes,
it's growing
yes.
in front of your eyes.
And I also just love, I've had it a few times, like I love the experience of when I'm writing a character, it's sort of half there and the actor who like locks in.
Mm.
And then I feel like I'm tailoring something to them.
Mm-hmm.
I like that feeling a lot. So I find that I kind of wait for that person to breathe breath into the character before it finally finds its finish.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that's just something that very much excites me about it, about the process. Like, I just love rehearsal. That's the other thing I realized with myself. I just like love being in rehearsal.
I want to shift our conversation a little bit to your service on the council of the guild. We, of course, became officers together during the shutdown in 2021. And I know that you first joined the council in 2016. And I wanted to ask you what inspired you to first run for council and what's it been like for you?
I was really inspired by, I think like most people, I didn't understand what the guild was. And I didn't understand what council was. And then I had a very bad contractual crisis early in my career that was the product of a negligent agent, a pretty insidious theater, and I felt very helpless. And at the time, and still kind of now, Marcia Norman, the great Marcia Norman, was really a mentor to me at that time, and she was like, you need to bring this to the guild, and you need to speak with Ralph Sevish. And I had this, Ralph met with me in his office and talked me through what was going on and gave me very good advice for nothing. You know, and I was like, man, it's so crazy that we don't understand that the guild is that kind of place where we're supposed to come together and talk broadly and in confidence with each other about what's going on in the field. And anyway, so I joined the council because I felt like I got to figure out how to keep this kind of flame going. Mm-hmm. I could also feel that at the time, especially because I think now the council is very different, there's all this like institutional knowledge that the generation before us has that no one was taking on. And I've always felt that that's why I'm in academia. I just believe in like, you know, when you think about theater, it's this very old form of that we've been handing down to each other for like thousands of years. And I just felt like someone had to show up and try to hold that knowledge or hold that purpose or that mission. And that's why I did it. And I didn't know what I was doing for a very long time on council. I knew the spirit that was compelling me was about trying to send out a beacon to young writers like me who found themselves in very bad situations professionally and didn't know how to get help. And also to find a way to gather the troops and root out those bad actors from the field as much as I could. But then in the process of being around, I saw where I was needed. I revived the awards committee, which had been defunct for years, and wanted to take on not just the management and dispersal of the awards that the guild oversees, which are quite substantial and for the most part geared towards supporting early, mid, and established writers, and both in New York and not. I wanted to think and spend a lot of time meditating on and philosophizing about what it meant for writers to celebrate each other, because there's really no other place where playwrights are literally awarding other playwrights. I thought that was such a noble thing. But also I felt there was this interesting thing happening amongst my immediate cohort of New York playwrights, for the most part. I noticed so many of us were depending upon foundational support and grants, which we were applying for or not applying for, to subsist as writers. And no one was kind of talking through the tax implications of that, the financial implications of that. I just was suddenly like, wait, I think there's a self-education that needs to happen for a lot of writers around themselves as economic actors in the field. And in the awards committee felt like the place to have those big conversations. And it wound up being quite true. I think it sparked conversations within the council based on the work that I was doing with my co-chair at the time, Joshua Harmon, that I think opened up a lot of conversations about the meaningfulness of this money for young writers mm-hmm. in a way that sometimes the most successful amongst us don't understand how little the least successful of us live on. You know, I just wanted to have a conversation about money. And that's how that kind of began. So that was the spirit of it. And I also really just fell in love with the staff of the Guild, like Terry Stratton and Amy Mazik and Emmanuel Wilson. And just really inspired by these people who have decided to dedicate their lives to very specific artisans in this very specific field. And it's been really satisfying work so far, I would say.
Yeah.
And I would say that being an officer, you and Amanda and Chris was such a bright light during this pandemic because we really tried to like figure out what was going on and how to make sure when we step out of this moment, whenever we step out of it, playwrights are going to feel stronger and more clear about their purpose and their work and identities than ever.
Yes, very much so. I love that talking to various counselors this season about how they've been inspired to advocate for playwrights. And it's really such a generous act. And I really value all of it and all of the contributions that all of you have brought to the Guild. It's really been...
And you too, Christine, like this, the talkback is a huge new part of the Guild. And I think it's just opening up the kind of windows and doors to people who...
Thank you. I love it. I love being able to give people... Like who is... People have probably heard you talk a lot about your fabulous plays that have won all these awards. But who has heard until today about your adaptation of Goosebumps?
Nobody.
Right?
But you. You're like basically... Oprah or whatever. You just got it out of me. Yeah. It's so funny. I remember when I moved to New York for the first time and I didn't know jack crap about anything. I Googled Playwrights New York blog and there were three blogs.
Uh-huh.
And it was Jason Grote,
uh-huh.
Sheila Callahan, and Adam Zimkowitz. Those were the only three blogs
wow.
I could find. It was the only way I could get resources or understand anything about trying to be a playwright. And I'm just thinking now, like, it's so different.
Yes.
If you come here and you want to understand the landscape or have to be part of this, it's just, like, such a great time to be a young writer. I moved to New York in 2006. And I was actually doing a master's program at NYU and something called performance studies, writing quietly on the side. And I just, the only tickets I could really afford were off Broadway for, back then we had the Fringe Festival,
sure.
if you
yep.
recall that.
Yep.
Crazy moment. And if you wanted to be a theater maker, you just had to figure out where to go and hopefully hang around long enough someone would be like, do you want to make something? But a few years into that was the phenomenon of the emerging writers groups. So there was the Public, the Soho Rep had their writer mm-hmm. director's lab, and then New York Theater Workshop had an emerging artists of color fellowship mm-hmm. at the time. And so the Public had started this thing called the emerging writers group, and I was in the second class of that. So again, that was because the Ford Foundation, Time Warner, all these places were suddenly caring about supporting emerging playwrights. And so suddenly the industry was flush with funding to start these essentially scouting initiatives. And I'm getting into the Public Writers Group and being like, what is this? It's crazy. They gave you headshots. You were talking to professionals. There was a real kind of pre-professional element to it. And at the end of that, they gave me my first production, which is a play called Neighbor and their public lab, Neighbors in the Public Lab. But even then, I didn't have any mentors who were playwrights. I was working at the time for a theater critic. That was the one mentor I had, which was a little complicated. And I just didn't know anything about anything. And then I applied to Juilliard because a friend of mine, her name was Janine Neighbors, and we were both in the Ars Nova's playgroup. She was like, I think you should apply to Juilliard. So I was like, okay, I guess we'll just do it because I need health insurance. And it was like a psychotic experience. But I getting like A, applying would be like getting in and just being very confused. I was like homeless. I was like living on an air mattress basically in a random sublet. Like I got whooping cough. Like
oh
it was
my
crazy.
Goodness.
It was a crazy set. So yeah, so I literally applied to Juilliard because I was desperate. I needed health insurance. And then But then I wound up, you know, it was like so serendipitous because that place changed my life, which had everything to do with Marsha Norman and Chris Durang, mm-hmm. who at the time were running it. I never had playwright mentors, you know, and also Jim Houghton was running the drama program at the time. And he was just like such a visionary person. And I had never been embedded with actors in that way. So for the first time ever, I understood what an actor was and what actors do. Mm-hmm. And that really transformed the way that I wrote. So I think it didn't give me a lay of the land. Like, I didn't learn about the business actually from Juilliard, but I suddenly was developing these very crucial relationships, which I can't believe I got as far as I did without having them. I think any playwright now definitely needs to A, know actors, B, have a real mentorship or relationship to someone who can help answer those questions that only someone with a bit of wisdom can. And also you just need like a tribe of people to be working with. That's just the three things, yeah. I think.
But also, it seems to me one of the morals of the story is that you took a leap of faith back when you first applied for these fellowships that you didn't know about, yeah. And look where they
went.
No
idea. I often would think to myself, if I ran to my 22-year-old self, would he even believe what I had to tell him? Because I truly did. I had a premiere at the Public Theater. I was like 26, 27 years old. Wow. Like, my first apartment was on Mott and Bleecker Street. And I would walk by the Public all the time and be like, oh, I can't wait to like be 40 and finally maybe have a show here. Yeah. I just really did. I truly, and it's because you don't know what's happening.
Right.
It was like very radical to meet other young playwrights in the city. Because again, there was no way to meet each other because no one was getting produced. And a lot of friends wanted to be novelists or like poets. But I just really didn't know any playwrights because in some ways I think you still live with the shame of being like a theater kid, right, in high school. But also like, how do you show your work or share your work as a playwright? So I was in this like pretty wonderful class at of ours, and other people included like Annie Baker, she and I have been teaching together for almost a decade now. Dear friend Amy Herzog, Sam Hunter, like, we were all just kids who were curious about this thing. And it felt like a hobby, like a very expensive hobby. But somehow there was something really powerful in meeting someone who was interested in the thing that made you so singular in your own life. So does that make sense?
Yes, I think that's so incredible. Also, the idea that you were able to meet and surround yourself with people who believed in illuminating your voice, not, like you say, what makes you singular, not trying to change you into whatever they thought you should be or what people in the commercial world might want. Can you talk about that a little bit, if you've ever had any pushback for what you want to say? Because I know your reputation is really writing plays that are very forthright and unapologetic in their sometimes controversial.
It's so funny. Things. I don't know. It's a good question. Because you believe in what you're doing and you just back it up and you just keep doing it. That's all you have to do. And so there is that. And I still get pushback all the time. Like, I still expect pushback. But I also had this, I remember I had my first really negative review and I got to have lunch with a playwright named Mark Ravenhill, who I really love. And he was a part of this kind of in-your-face generation of playwrights in the British world. I met him for a random coffee or something because his agent put us in touch, or I don't remember why we even got together. And I was licking my wounds. And he was just like, listen, this is dumb. He's like, you're trying to do something that's different or new. And in some ways, you're critiquing something that these reviewers are responsible for the upholding of. So you should feel weird if they do love what you do.
Interesting.
It was interesting. Yeah, he was like, if your mission here is to actually talk about things that are difficult to talk about, don't expect people to praise you for it. Because difficulty is not a positive feeling. And that really changed my sense of strength about just doing what I want to do. And living with the fact that sometimes it's going to miss the mark, sometimes it's going to fail. But you have to have faith in whatever your mission or your drive is. You have to work hard to have that faith because you have to really stand by what you're trying to do. And I think that's how I've managed to stick around and not go crazy.
Thank you so much for all of your insight and great stories. It's always such a joy to get to talk to you because we haven't seen each other in person in years.
I know. And I'm just so happy to finally be on this podcast, yes, which I love.
Yes, thank you for joining us.
I'm going to skip this episode, obviously. I'm not going to listen to myself talk, but I'm just so honored to be included in this gallery of amazing talks with you.
Thank you. My thanks to Brandon. To hear all our episodes, you can find us on the Broadway Podcast Network or Apple Podcasts. Please be sure to rate us and leave a review. Learn more about our guests from all our episodes by visiting www.dramatistguild.com. This episode was produced by Amy Von Masick and me, Christine Toy Johnson. Music was composed by Andrea Daly. Special thanks to Dick and Rogers Sound Studio in Vancouver, British Columbia. Talkback is a production of the Dramatists Guild of America and is distributed by the Broadway Podcast Network. Join the conversation online by using hashtag DGTalkback. As always, to be continued.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah,
not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.